When I've mentioned to people that we were going to talk with you on the show, it seems like everybody I talked to thought of something different and said, oh, Al Kooper with Mike Bloomfield, and Al Kooper who produced Lynyrd Skynyrd, Blues Project, George Harrison, Dylan, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Alice Cooper. Obviously, that versatility has been a hallmark of your many decades in the music business. Is that something you set out to do when you began this journey at about 14?
Well, the only thing that I set out to do is I wanted to be a musician. And then I wanted this, and then I wanted that, but it was all within the realm of music.
Well, you've certainly accomplished that. One of the big jump starts to your career was working as a contract songwriter with a couple of other guys and coming up with big hits for Gary Lewis and the Playboys and then Gene Pitney. How much did that open doors for you?
Well, the doors were open. You just had to marry the right song to the right producer, because This Diamond Ring was originally written for the R&B group The Drifters. And when I heard the Gary Lewis record, I was very disappointed.
Yeah, was that Snuff Garrett who produced that?
It was. Very good.
Yeah, and a very different take, I'm sure, than what The Drifters did.
Well, what happened was, I remember I came up in the elevator one day with the owner of the publishing company we worked for, and he said, I got a cover of that Drifter song you guys wrote. And I said, who did it? He said, Snuff Garrett produced it. And I said, is he making R&B records now? And he said, no. And I said, uh-oh.
Now, I will say, we had Gary Lewis on our show last summer. And he was very complimentary about the quality of that song. Gave him a career, for goodness sakes.
Well, he had, in all fairness to him, he had a lot of hits after it.
Absolutely. You made your way to Greenwich Village to continue your musical journey. How did you first come to meet Bob Dylan?
At that recording session.
That was the first time. Oh, wow. Well, and I'm not going to ask you to tell that story, because I know you've told that a lot.
you've seen that clip.
I have, yeah. But especially with the movie, the Scorsese movie was so good, and you were such a big part of that. What was that experience like working with Martin Scorsese?
Never saw him.
Really? Wow.
Informationally speaking, all he did in that film was edit it.
Well, he did a heck of a job, because it came out so very good. Now, we know about the story of Like a Rolling Stone. You also played organ on The Stones' You Can't Always Get What You Want. And did I read correctly that you also played French horn on that?
Yes.
Wow. And then, of course, the formation of Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and that very first album, which to me and a lot of people was the best album the group ever did. Why did that go wrong? Why weren't you happy? Why weren't other people happy with that configuration?
I was primarily happy. The drummer and the guitar player were very unhappy with me. So rather than fight that, I just left.
You made your way eventually to Georgia, the Atlanta area, and you heard Lynyrd Skynyrd playing in a local establishment. Like their music, and I thought it was very interesting too. You point out that this group, people think of them as the epitome of Southern rock, a freewheeling sound, but these were professionals who did it right and worked very hard, even on those solos.
Well, they had a very intelligent, hard-working ethic. I didn't find that out till after I was smitten, but then when I worked with them, I had never really worked with anyone who had been so well prepared for the making of a record. Most people are not as well prepared.
We're talking.
That's why it takes months sometimes to make an album.
We're talking with Al Kooper here on Downtown. How long did it take you to make one of the most acclaimed albums of the 1960s, Super Session, with Mike Bloomfield and Stephen Stills?
About a week.
Wow. So there must have been some preparation going into that then.
Well, no, because the whole concept of that album was it was a jam session. So the actual recording was two nights.
Well, that was an incredible piece of work there. I read a comment, too, that you knew Jimi Hendrix. You were sort of neighbors with him. And you've said that the public persona of Jimi Hendrix was not at all what he was like as a human being.
That's true. It was the antithesis. He was a very quiet, gentle, nice guy. And I could count on probably one hand the times that we spent together, but they were wonderful times.
He's a
very nice guy.
We've had occasion on this show to talk with several people, Jimmy Webb, Mickey Dolenz, Van Dyke Parks, and his son Keith, about one of my favorite musicians of all time, Harry Nilsson. You knew him, you produced the tribute album. What are your memories of Harry Nilsson?
Well, I had, when he first came out, I went berserk over his recording of Without Her, which I eventually covered on the Blood, Sweat, and Tears album.
Right.
But when his version came out, I went nuts over that. And then everything that came after it, whatever album it was on, I went nuts over that album. But that track specifically, I thought was beautifully produced, arranged. When I did it, I didn't attempt to copy it. I did it a whole other way because I couldn't mess with how great they did it.
Speaking of music that you love, for your money, is Pet Sounds the greatest album in the history of pop and rock music?
I would have to say so.
In terms of the production, the songwriting, or the whole package?
The whole package.
Your book, Backstage Passes and Backstabbing Bastards, it's been out in three different versions. I think it's the best book ever about the music business. And you didn't pull any punches with that one.
Well, I mean, if you're going to write a book, you might as well, tell the truth.
Well, you certainly did that. I love the stories. So terrific. And as you look around today, you're still making music. You're still performing. What's the state of rock music here in 2018?
Well, when I was very young, when I was like 11 and 12, I fell in love with rock and roll, which was sort of new at the time. And my parents and people their age were disgusted by it. And that helped. Then I had my own music, and old people didn't like it. When rap music came out, I sort of embraced it because I was a big fan of soul music, and the full transition didn't happen immediately with rap music. And as rap music became more popular, it changed from its original version, and I hated it. And I hated it for two reasons. One is it was mostly talking, and it was fake instruments. There weren't real instruments in it. It was all synthesizers. And there was a lot of cursing, which wasn't necessary. And then I looked at myself and I said, well, you're just like your parents. It's exactly like what my parents thought about rock and roll. And I said, okay, so I'm old, but it doesn't reach me. But it's not intended for me.
No, but it's interesting, too.
So
that
I completely understand that. But I can't listen to it.
It's interesting, though, that your music has been sampled possibly more than anybody by those rap and hip-hop artists.
That's called ironic.
Exactly. That's what it is indeed. Well, Al, it's a real treat for us to have a chance to talk with you. Glad we were able to catch up with you. Thank you so much for making time for us.
My pleasure.